The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hi guys, welcome back to Textory. In today's episode, we will be talking about women's work, basically. But before we jump into that, do check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textory for some more textory-related content. Anyway, let's talk about women's work today, specifically about the period of the First World War and how it sort of shifted women's involvement in society. So first of all, women have always worked. There is this strange myth that the First World War happened and all of a sudden women were allowed to work because there was not enough men. That is not quite true. If you were not the privileged class, you had to work throughout history as a woman, on top of taking care of your children and family, usually. You know, you worked either on a farm physically, you worked as a domestic servant, you worked as a street seller, you worked as a sex worker. Also, a lot of women in history actually owned businesses. But the problem is those businesses were usually under their husband's names, so you wouldn't even know that they were the actual owners. So then World War I came, and the big difference was not women working, because it happened before, as I said, it was the norm, but women working in fields that were previously unavailable to them. So, for example, in 1914, around 23% of British women in working age were employed. And in 1918, by the end of the war, that number was already between 38 and 46%. And similarly, in 1914, a German arms production company, Krupp, employed no women, zero. And by 1917, women made up 30% of the workers. So that's a massive increase. A total of 1.4 million German women were employed in the war labor force. Some women were also on the ground in Europe, you know, nurses, drivers, etc. Maria Skłodowska-Curie invented a mobile X-ray unit and she did X-rays on the battlefront. But even though they entered the manly areas of workforce, they were still discriminated against. For example, female nurses were allowed and everyone was fine with them. We had over 3,000 American nurses working in France, but female physicians were having trouble and were facing obstacles and were not treated seriously because that's a man's job. Women were also paid lower wages, and some people were actually worried that because of that, after the war, the workforce would be just women because they're cheaper to hire and that men would be jobless when they come back. But that didn't happen, and they would just get fired or, you know, stay in the workplace still earning the lower wage, and then men came back from the war and were working with them earning more. UK female workers that were working on trams and buses actually initiated a strike in 1918 due to unfair treatment. So today we are reading The Ladies' Garment Worker, which was a magazine of the International Ladies' Garment Workers Union. That's a long name. It's from April 1918, so the war is still going. International Ladies' Garment Workers Union was basically a labor union for women employed in the clothing industry in the United States. And at the time, it was one of the first unions to focus on a female membership, and it was one of the largest unions in the country. It was established in 1900, and it became more involved in politics around 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire happened. So today we're reading their magazine, which is interesting because it's very niche. Like, it's clearly information meant for the members of the union. It's a lot of local information. It's a lot of information about meetings, about board members, etc. So a lot of content that is not really saying anything to me, but it also has interesting bits that I decided to take out and make an episode out of this because it speaks a lot about how women's labor looked like back then. And about implementing rules that to us are somehow obvious, but back then they were controversial. They were just like proposed. Standards of employment for women. Efforts should be made to restrict the work of women to 8 hours. Then they list like a bunch of standards that they think women's employment should follow. Prohibition of night work. The employment of women on night shifts should be prevented as a necessary protection, morally and physically. It's going to be a bit difficult because we don't know what standards for men were back then and what men workers proposed. So it's possible that a lot of these were proposed by both male and female workers and not just because the workers were female. Rest periods. No woman should be employed for a longer period than 4.5 hours without a break for a meal, and a recess of 10 minutes should be allowed in the middle of each working period. Time for meals. At least 30 minutes should be allowed for a meal, and this time should be lengthened to 45 minutes or an hour if the working day exceeds 8 hours. Meals should not be eaten in the workroom. Saturday half holiday. The Saturday half holiday should be considered an absolute essential for women under all conditions. Saturday half holiday, I'm assuming they worked on a Saturday then. I mean, it was pretty standard until recently, at least in the Eastern Bloc, because I know that my parents' parents used to work on Saturdays. Seats. For women who sit at their work, seats with backs should be provided unless the occupation renders this impossible. For women who stand at work, seats should be available and their use permitted at regular intervals. As a chronic leaning forward person, a seat with a back would be useless for me because I'm always slouching. Lifting weights. No woman should be required to lift repeatedly more than 25 pounds in any single load. This is an interesting point because when I was reading about the British female workers, there was a whole case of the government trying to determine whether women should be paid the same as men. And they determined in 1917 or 1918 that they shouldn't because they were weaker, so they're gonna do less work. But the women were arguing that they've already done the work. They've already proved that they can do just as much work as men. You know, they've delivered the wartime standards that the men were unable to do because they were not there. Eventually, that was the argument that they came up with. And I think it still echoes a lot in the modern world because obviously, yeah, biologically, people assigned female at birth are going to be weaker. But I feel like this argument back then was also used for like any type of job. For example, you would want to have an office job and they would be like, but women get tired more easily. What if she's on her period? And, you know, it would be used as an explanation of why there is still inequality. And they actually talk about this in the next point, which is replacement of men by women. When it is necessary to employ women in work hitherto done by men, care should be taken to make sure that the task is adapted to the strength of women. The standards of wages hitherto prevailing for men in the process should not be lowered where women render equivalent service. The hours for women engaged in such processes, of course, should not be longer than those formerly worked by men. I think what they're alluding to here is the cases when women would be getting a lower wage, but the standards that were expected of men would be applied to them still. Let's say they would have to carry just as much, but then earn less by default. Tenement housework. No work shall be given out to be done in rooms used for living purposes or in rooms directly connected with living rooms in any dwelling or tenement. I mean, it's healthy to keep your work out of your bedroom, I guess. Okay, and then we have standards for employment of minors, and they say no child under 14 years of age shall be employed at any work under any conditions. Which for 1918 is pretty... It's a novelty because not even 10 years back, that was completely normal to have children working in factories and doing heavy work and just running in the streets selling papers. I mean, it was still the case after the war, but you can see that that's where they started sort of talking about it. They were like, this is not right. If we're fighting for workers' rights, we have to include minors as well because they are part of the workforce. Unfortunately... Then there's an interesting article about women doing heavy railroad work. At a meeting of Director General of Railroads, McAdoo's Wage Commission, Miss Pauline Goldmark, sister-in-law of United States Supreme Court Justice Brandeis, gave figures to show that women are being employed in increasing numbers to do heavy railroad work. One railroad employs 400 on one division, and another has a total of 1,517 women workers, she said. Ms. Goldmark declared women were lifting weights of as much as 50 pounds as drill press operators. Okay, we've got to do a European conversion here because I have no idea how much 50 pounds is. Okay, that's 23 kilograms. That's not too bad. She told of investigating conditions at a factory in Zanesville, Ohio, where many women are employed. The majority of women at this point, she said, are engaged at hard labor such as loading scrap iron, sorting scrap iron, wheeling iron castings in wheelbarrow, etc. The women are loading scrap and sorting work out in the yards, with no protection from the intense rays of the sun or from the weather. These women wear overalls and large brim hats. They hand the iron up from the ground to others in the cars who pile it. The hours are 9 a day and 54 a week, with 1 half-hour for lunch. Wages are 20 cents an hour, and $1.50 is deducted each month for relief purposes. Men are paid 21 cents an hour for the same kind of work. I'm also thinking for women that were up to that point not really used to such heavy manual labor, because the heaviest manual labor you could do as a woman pre-World War was probably farm work and working in factories. But even working in factories was mostly not as heavy as what they were doing during the war. So I'm thinking it must have been a shock to go into these conditions. No one had time to make any sort of adjustments for you. You were just thrown into this man's world, trying to make the best out of it, trying to survive, having this responsibility on your shoulders because you were basically helping your family members that were a part of the war and trying to do your best while also being expected to uphold a standard that was done by skilled men before the war, because obviously the men that worked in all the factories, it was not their first day when they were drafted. So they've been doing it for years. They were probably trained much better than those women. And then you were also getting paid less on top of that.
I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Another article says, let girls make homes. The feminine war helper who dons a knobby uniform to drive a motor truck was frowned upon by the National Congress of Mothers and Parent Teachers Association in annual convention in Atlantic City. A report on this subject said, the preparing of women to be automobile drivers, truck chauffeurs, and for other masculine lines of work is not half so important as preparing for wholesome economic homemaking and wise and loving child training. The committee declared its position on this question is not a hobby and asked, where can the second line of defense better be established than in wisely directed homes? I find it interesting that in the age of trying to fight for your rights as a worker, this was still the topic of a discussion. Should women even work? Should they not be stay-at-home mothers and focus on cultivating their homes? And obviously this was a discussion of the richer women because, as I said, anyone poor at the time, which was the majority, did not really have a choice. I mean, obviously there were families where only one parent was working, but in a lot of the cases, the amount of work that the woman had to do was just as big. But it's interesting that it was not a conflict of those views. It was sort of a part of the discussion. So even in a magazine like this, they were like, should we even work? Because I think it's important to say that not everyone dreams of labor. And obviously, when you can't do it, it's annoying. But probably a lot of the women were like, okay, but what happens after the war? Are we still going to be expected to drive trucks and cars? Because we think it's temporary and we kind of want to go back as well. I think it's also an interesting point because it wasn't like every woman in 1914 when they started allowing them into all the heavy industries were like, phew, finally, I've been waiting so long for this. I mean, it was probably nice to finally be recognized as a human being, but I'm assuming a lot of them were worried, like, is that where we're going to end up? Then we have another article that is called Women War Workers. And there is some numbers in this again, so focus. But it also says, I mean, it mentions different lines of work that women did back then. There are approximately 1,266,061 women in the United States engaged in industrial work, which is either directly or indirectly necessary to carry on the war, according to an estimate based on surveys made in 15 states for the National League of Women's Service by Ms. Mary L. Aubineur, with the sanction and assistance of the Department of Labor. There were approximately 3,500 women engaged in munition factories in 1910. The number is now 100,000, according to Ms. Aubineur. That's a massive increase. That's how... Wait, how many percent is that? I need to do some quick math. Okay, that's a 2,857% increase in the number of women engaged in munition factories. And Ms. Aubineur said that this is like a conservative estimate, so it's probably much, much more. She includes airplanes when speaking of munition factories. Most of the women, it is stated, are engaged in weaving, sewing, and preserving food. I think it's difficult to comprehend the true scale of what women did during the war. And I'm also speaking about the Second World War because when I was researching the Women's Royal Naval Service, I was so surprised at what women actually did because what we think is like administration, maybe making food for the soldiers or, you know, all sorts of work that we think women did back then. But for example, the Wrens in the British Navy, they basically did everything short of shooting. They were literally trained in how to use weapons. They were testing the weapons. They were testing all sorts of equipment. So they were basically trained to use all the equipment, but they were not allowed to, which is crazy. They could build torpedoes, they could test the torpedoes. They just did not give the orders to use the torpedoes. And I think on a smaller scale, it was probably also the case in the First World War, where to have women make something, you had to explain how it works. So all these women were probably highly trained in a lot of things that they didn't need to know after the war. I mean, I'm assuming that a lot of them did not continue that sort of work after the war. So to have these women in the 20s knowing very niche things about producing munitions or airplanes is a crazy thought. I don't think I thought about this before, because it's, you know, it's large numbers of women. It's a big percentage of the local communities. So these are the snippets that I found interesting. There is also a lot of content that, as I said, is very much for the members. For example, we have a whole section of local news and events. And they say, in this department, which is a regular feature of this journal every month, local life and movement is being reported for the information of our members and readers. And in this particular issue, they're focusing on cloakmakers unions, which is so niche. I didn't know there were whole unions for this, but wait till you hear how many unions there were specifically for that, just cloak making. So Ladies and Mrs. Cloak Operators Union, local number one, says, the secretary says, the cloak trade in New York is extremely busy. In fact, we are having an exceptional season, and all the cloak makers say that we have not had a spring season like this in many years, and that it exceeds by far the past fall season. Baltimore Cloak Makers, local number four, says, we have been busy during the last few weeks in a little town, Cumberland, Maryland, with organizing work, in which we had the assistance of the local Women's Trade Union League. The Baltimore Dry Goods House, one of the biggest concerns in the city, opened up a cloak shop in that town, and of course, its prime intention was to beat the union and operate on a non-union basis. We, however, succeeded in going after and getting the girls, most of the workers in that shop are women, to join the union, and we organized them into a local of their own. Boston Cloakmakers, locals number 12, 24, 56, and 73, so you had so many cloakmakers locals just in Boston. Conditions are pretty bright in Boston. There is plenty of work in the shops, and all the cloakmakers in Boston are busy. The news that the members of the International voted for Boston as the convention city for 1918 brought a lot of enthusiasm into our ranks. Cleveland Cloakmakers, local number 26. When we speak of Cleveland, it is about time that we had made up our minds that as long as there will be no official recognition of the union by the local manufacturers, the organization will have no stability. It may come to life at the beginning of each season, but it is sure to fall apart before the season is over. Cincinnati Cloakmakers, locals number 30, 63, and 98. The season in the local cloak trade is not bad, particularly in the larger shops, where there is plenty of work and the workers make decent wages. In the smaller shops, things are not quite so good, and in some instances, the cloak makers employed there had to stop for a day or two during the last few weeks as their employers could not get sufficient goods to fill their orders. So the magazine is ended with a poem about labor, which is quite interesting. I don't think it's necessarily about working women, but it kind of adds up. And they've used it, so they probably identified with it to a certain degree. I've builded your ships and your railroads. I've worked in your factories and mines. I've builded the roads you drive on. I've crushed the ripe grapes for your wines. I've worked late at night on your garments. I gathered the grain for your bread. I built the fine house that you live in. I printed the books you have read. I've linked two great oceans together. I've spanned your rivers with steel. I built your towering skyscrapers and also your automobile. I've gone out to wrecked ships in the lifeboats when the storm loudly cried for its prey. I've guarded your house from marauders. I have turned the night into day. Wherever there's progress, you'll find me. Without me, the world could not live. And yet you would seek to destroy me with the meager pittance you give. Today you may grind me in slavery. You may dictate to me from the throne. But tomorrow I throw off my fetters and I am ready to claim what I own. You masters of field and of factory, I am mighty and you are but few. No longer I'll bow in submission, I am labor and ask for my due. I think it's especially interesting in the modern discussion regarding the necessity of labor, because obviously we're all stressed out by AI taking our jobs, and it's like, do we even need to work? Where does women's work fall into that? Will women even work? Will they be forced back in their houses, raising children? I think there's a lot of doubts and anxieties that we have with the changing reality of labor and workforce, and where do humans fall into that? I think we're still safe for some time, so we don't actually have to worry about it for now, but it's interesting because it's a completely different discussion than what people had back in 1918. I mean, back then, labor was the base of society. It was, everything was built on that. It was absolutely necessary because otherwise societies would just not survive. And in wartime as well, it was definitely even more visible, because if it weren't for labor, there would be political consequences and social consequences that were just too disastrous to even think about. But it's also always very eye-opening to be reading old texts and have people speculate or propose things that are so obvious to us now. Like, we tend to forget that people had to fight for what we have nowadays. It wasn't like they woke up one day after the war and were like, okay, yeah, everyone's getting a lunch break. That's going to be the law now. It obviously took time and effort from the working people to get those privileges. So the fact that you can now go and have a coffee in your office is probably a result of people, including a lot of women, that fought for those rights. I mean, okay, coffee is a bad example, but you know what I mean. Anyway, speaking of labor, I am going on a break. I will be doing my annual break for Textree, so this is the last episode, and I will see you again after the break in the new year of 2026. I hope you enjoyed this season. I will be away preparing new episodes, new texts, new tasty tea, and I'll see you after New Year's. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out my Patreon at patreon.com/textree, and I'll be back in another episode in another season. So bye.